is titled Loops and Holes, Negotiating Human Rights at the Centre. It approaches the themes of this panel from the vantage point of UN human rights monitoring, specifically the documentary cycles of the UN Human Rights Committee, the treaty body that monitors how states comply with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The paper includes a fair amount of technical detail that I have, in the interest of time, attempted to condense. I look forward to elaborating any points that may remain unclear in the Q&A. You know, this issue was way ahead of its time. No work had been done to prepare the ground. We are standing on the terrace outside the cafeteria of the Palais Wilson at the heart of Geneva. The Lac Leman is located in front of us, and it has developed gentle waves. It is warm, but somewhat windy, as is often the case by the water. The day has already turned to the afternoon, and we should be heading back indoors, as the UN Human Rights Committee is likely back in session. Yet I delay finishing my coffees for just a little longer, as I hope to learn more of how one maneuvers inside the opaque transparency of the UN Human Rights apparatus to make one's case to form an issue. My accompaniment, an NGO delegate of British origin in his 50s, who I'm calling John, knows this and more, having been engaged with human rights work for decades, thus embodying significant institutional memory. Preparing the ground, looping and ripening an issue, a textbook example of the processes of social negotiation via which things are really done. Simultaneously, it is an exploration, an explanation of how UN reality forms the playing field of insiders at the exclusion of those who are without the social and financial capital required for such negotiations, no matter how compelling their cases might be. The transformation of human rights from tools of emancipation for the world's underdogs to the site of professional and activist engagement by the world's privileged. This panel has invited us to consider the processes of social negotiation that accompany bureaucracies, the ways in which bureaucracy serves to maintain power as well as constitutes a distinct mode of exerting power, the limits imposed to negotiation by the materiality of bureaucracy, and finally, how in the processes of social negotiation the formal and the informal become enmeshed. In my paper, I will engage with these themes via an ethnographic insight of the loops and holes, or loopholes, that human rights insiders resort to as they negotiate their causes in the opaque transparency of the UN human rights apparatus. More specifically, I will explore techniques and concrete moments of lobbying by NGO delegates as they seek recognition for diverse issues in front of expert committees known as UN human rights treaty bodies, simultaneously seeking to expand the scope of what human rights are understood to encompass. My paper, and research more generally, connects with the body of anthropological scholarship produced over the past decades, exploring diverse aspects of bureaucracies, including documents and meetings at the UN, as well as other international organizations and NGOs. One aspect of my research has been to focus on the movement of artifacts, people and expertise that such practices and as UN human rights monitoring both build on and result in. In this analysis, I build on the concept of center and periphery borrowed from the world system analysis of the late Immanuel Wallerstein. I explore this movement's historical foundations and contemporary consequences, including how it reproduces and solidifies prevailing power relations. Here my work connects with scholarship produced by international lawyers, particularly the group called as CRIT or TWAIL, the aka Third World Approaches to International Law. This analytical framework is also present in this paper, with the center being embodied by the Geneva Human Rights Hub. In dictionary definitions, a loophole is characterized as a small opening that permits the entrance of light, air, or observation. It is a way of avoiding something and further a way around an obstruction that would otherwise keep a person from obtaining a goal. In this paper, I utilize loopholes in two significances. The first refers to the processes of social negotiation relied on by insiders of the international human rights regime to maneuver around the obstructions imposed by the formalities of UN bureaucracies. The second is the manner in which these negotiations embody a paradox between the ideal of human rights as tools for the world's underdogs and reality, namely how these negotiations become a loophole for privilege. In describing the inner contours of the UN human rights apparatus, this concept notes to Foucault's work in specific, I use a second metaphor, ice. Just like ice, the microstructure of the UN apparatus is porous and characterized by subtle openings or holes. Just like as ice thaws, perhaps melts a bit, then freezes again, also the microstructure of this apparatus keeps changing via the introduction of new action plans and expert bodies, accompanied by the annihilation of existing ones. The structure also changes with the continued rotation of personnel, resulting in the recasting of networks and working methods, not unlike what we heard with Colin's paper. Opaque transparency captures further the constant interplay of the formal and the informal, characteristic of many processes within the apparatus. It also captures fragility, which is an intrinsic part of the UN human rights apparatus. Just as ice breaks by a sudden blow, so may parts of the apparatus be instantly shattered by unexpected state budget cuts. This is an all too familiar experience to insiders, resulting in a shared sense of unpredictability and even cynicism toward the UN as an organization, sentiments balanced by the unwavering belief and commitment that many UN insiders have for protecting human rights. In all, the metaphor of ice captures the opaque transparency of UN reality characterized by fuzzy logic, an expression borrowed from Bourdieu. In their study of the universal periodic review of the UN Human Rights Council, Jane Cowan and Julie Bilot have concluded how sometimes the very practices that are supposed to guarantee transparency can in reality cloud it over. At the outset, this outset may appear problematic or as constituting a flaw, transparency being one of the greatest desirables for contemporary bureaucracies. Yet, insiders may view things differently. Opacity may form a desirable shield to the apparatus's fragility, simultaneously strengthening its ability to protect human rights. Human rights insiders, whom I in my work call guardians of vision, are also aware of how to take practical advantage of OPAC transparency. They are aware of the elements that can and need to be highlighted in human rights work, as well as made exaggeratedly visible in order to guarantee the successful operation and legitimacy of these monitoring mechanisms. They are also aware of the elements that need to be hidden, such as their personal realm of influence. My research explores these themes around one particular genre of international human rights monitoring known as UN human rights treaty bodies. Treaty bodies are committees formed of 15 to 20 experts, often meaning professors of human rights law, that convene annually to two or three sessions of a few weeks, mostly in Geneva. The concrete task of treaty bodies is to monitor how states comply with the obligations that they have undertaken by becoming parties to UN human rights covenants. The creation of treaty bodies leads us back to the 1940s, when planning for the post-World War II order was in full swing. Distinct activists lobbied for the creation of a legally binding international Bill of Rights, modeled after the US Bill of Rights, which would be backed up by a human rights court operating under the UN with universal jurisdiction. Due to firm state opposition, this goal was never even close to being realized. Instead, the outcome was a bill broken into three pieces: the legally non-binding preamble, which became the Universal Declaration of Human Rights adopted in 1948, and the two main UN human rights covenant, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, both adopted in 1966 and entering into force in 1976. Instead of a court, UN treaty bodies were created to monitor them. Today, the total number of treaty bodies is 10, and they monitor, among others, the International Covenant on the Rights of the Child and the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, known as CEDAW. My ethnography has focused on the UN Human Rights Committee, not the Commission, as Thomas mentioned, which monitors the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and is commonly seen as the most authoritative and law-like of all UN human rights monitoring mechanisms. As this graph illustrates, the very purpose of treaty body work is to be cyclical, with one phase following another in a seamless continuum, thus creating infinite movement in the right direction, as I'm calling it in my ongoing book project. From a legal viewpoint, treaty bodies are curious things. Whereas their founding rests on clear legal grounds, aka distinct covenant provisions, in practice the committee's relationship to the law is subject to continued negotiations. These negotiations reflect an expansionary aim both for the increased role of the committee to address human rights concerns, as well as continually greater scope for what are legally recognized as human rights. The required space for these negotiations finds tangible presence in the very provisions of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that has created the committee, which states that the committee may determine its rules of procedure. In practice, the operations of the UN Human Rights Committee are structured around the processing of three primary genres of documents: periodic state reports, individual communications, and documents known as general comments. Of these, processing state reports occupies the bulk of the committee's time, culminating in sessions known as constructive dialogue. A state report is a summary of some dozens of pages by a state party on how it has realized the obligations enlisted in the covenant, with particular emphasis on how the state has improved its conduct from the previous cycle. In aesthetic terms, a state report is highly legalistic. The information it contains is organized around paragraphs and subparagraphs in a covenant-like manner, with repeated references to pieces of legislation. The tenor of state reports is matter-of-fact and objective. In terms of substance, state reports echo the current pulse of human rights monitoring. They highlight issues that are being addressed by diverse bodies of the human rights apparatus at the given moment. This is not coincidental, but finds a logical explanation of how state reports are compiled. Usually, the civil servants who are assigned with this task will begin by copy-pasting material that has been included in a report submitted to another UN monitoring body or a monitoring body in a regional arrangement. There are some consultative processes, but nevertheless, the importance of copy-pasting is significant. Thus, any individual document is always tightly connected to ongoing human rights dialogue, as was illustrated by Annelise Riles in her early work. The centrality of state reports in UN treaty body proceedings captures the most important obstruction that NGOs face as they attempt to forward their causes within the UN human rights apparatus. As only states are parties to UN human rights covenants, only states have the capacity to make public statements during the monitoring cycle by participating in something that's known as the constructive dialogue. Thus, the question becomes, how do NGOs get around the formal obstruction and find an entry point for joining negotiations on the issues that should be incorporated in the human rights dialogue carried out in front of the Human Rights Committee? To address this question, we need to go back to the Palais Wilson, and I need to start jumping ahead because I have too much to say with the time that I have left. The Palais itself is an important point. It was the former headquarters of the League of Nations, and today it serves as the office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. This is also where the constructive dialogue for treaty bodies happens, accompanied both by moments of improvisation and careful scripting. You see here the seating arrangement, which states where observers will sit, as well as members of the committee. The outcome is a mix of experiences ranging from moments of passionate engagement to moments of alienation and acute boredom. The thing here is that only states are able to make verbal interventions and NGOs are reduced to a silent audience. However, during the sessions, NGOs do have opportunities for engagement due to different mechanisms that have been created by UN insiders. The most important of these are lunchtime briefings that take place exclusively between members of the committee and NGO delegates. These briefings are further accompanied by something known as shadow reports, which complement NGO information to challenge the report of the state. Both the existence of NGO hearings and the importance invested in ancillary reports can be seen to embody loopholes created by UN insiders to maneuver around the obstructions formed by the formalities of UN bureaucracy that place states together with the information that states provide at the core of this monitoring mechanism. Or to put the same in insider human rights lingua, the obstruction formed by the S-word, aka state sovereignty. Thus, the existence of these NGO hearings owes itself directly to OPEC transparency, in which the guardians have delicately negotiated for a greater role of NGOs in the state-centric monitoring mechanism. So what happens here? These hearings are by no means sufficient alone for ensuring that NGOs succeed in having their issues included in the constructive dialogue. Instead, more systematic engagement is required. To understand these processes, we need to go back to the late afternoon coffee break at the terrace of the Palais Wilson. It is precisely via such moments that seasoned NGO delegates may seize unchoreographed moments to lobby for their causes. They may catch a member of the Human Rights Committee enjoying the last few afternoon rays of the sun or savoring a cigarette, subsequently engaging them for an impromptu chat over the issue that they represent. Or alternatively, they may engage with a member of the UN Secretariat to talk of the submission of a given document, perhaps exchange views on an informal NGO hearing. Here they have a very specific goal, to get the issue that they represent included in a document known as a list of issues which will form the backbone of the constructive dialogue. The importance of these moments is intensified by personal relations. In the non-stop movement accompanying UN treaty body sessions, people keep coming and going to and from the Palais Wilson, yet the people who stay put are realistically surprisingly few, thus allowing for insiders of the Geneva Human Rights Hub to become familiar with one another. Together, these moments of personal engagement become part of an ongoing looping through the holes of the ice-like structure of the UN human rights apparatus. They're instances of maturing an issue and preparing the ground for the issue's inclusion in the formal human rights dialogue. To go back to my discussion with John, when he first entered UN Human Rights Treaty Body proceedings in 2002, the issue he was represented was way ahead of its time. Consequently, the first time it was introduced through an individual communication, it was considered as inadmissible. Yet slowly things started to change, in part because of active lobbying. John recounts how, in the process, different moments of engagement build on top of each other. He describes going from one UN monitoring mechanism to another, trying to get the Human Rights Committee to pick up something that he himself has authored, and then later taking that mention by the committee to the Human Rights Council, for example, not as something that he said, but something that the committee said, and so forth and so forth. The same happens in regards to individual state reports. He contacts NGOs from a target country, encouraging them to submit reports to accompany the ones that he himself has submitted, therefore solidifying the role of the issue. Together, these form important steps in an ongoing process to negotiate how human rights are construed to be present in a given moment. These ethnographic glimpses concretize the social and financial capital required for participating in the elaborate processes of social negotiation. You have to be present in Geneva. You have to know how to engage. You need to know what are the right moments for engaging. These insights also help us to understand how some issues have found inclusion as mainstream human rights issues, whereas some others have not. The issue of LGBTI rights, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, and intersexual rights, offers a recent high-profile example of an issue that has found inclusion, whereas, for example, the rights of the elderly has not. This has been in part because the absence of similar orchestrated lobbying, which has caused these issues as not appearing as self-evident human rights issues. I'm running a bit in the interest of keeping time, and I want to conclude by asking, so what? So what? What can we learn from this exploration of loops and holes that is of relevance outside the subfields of the anthropology of human rights and bureaucracy? How might such inquiries serve to strengthen a more visible and influential anthropology beyond our discipline? Upon preparing for this paper, I realized that these issues formed an almost separate paper, with themes moving from the exaggeratedly technical nature that much pioneering anthropological work on human rights had adopted, perhaps in an attempt to solidify the legitimacy of these undertakings, to anthropology's perpetual sense of self-crisis, accompanied by a search of reinvigoration. I also realized how long it had been since someone had asked me the question, just what is anthropological about your work? It is perhaps worth noting how quickly the study of these fields has become solidified in our shared scholarly space, particularly for a discipline as conservative as anthropology. To conclude, during the past 7 decades, since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a massive global phenomenon has formed around human rights. We can locate this phenomenon in the human rights discourse, or discourses, community and artifacts, with human rights ideology located at the phenomenon's core. Over the past decades, all these elements have faced considerable expansion. What is today understood to form a human right is greatly more expansive than a few decades ago, when even the question of whether women's rights were unquestionably human rights was still debated. In most human rights scholarship authored primarily by international lawyers and international relations scholars, this expansion is unquestionably presented as a favorable development. And further, the mechanisms via which expansion has occurred are accepted without analytical curiosity. Instead, they are seen to represent an almost natural law-like progression of the unilinear development of mankind embodied by the spread of human rights ideology. An anthropological inquiry into such subtle mechanisms of expansion, as well as the moments of social negotiation, adds relevant nuances to this dominant image. This is also where I see the greatest potential for anthropological contributions, both within the study of human rights, bureaucracy, and beyond. Anthropological inquiries allow us to penetrate beyond the layers of the self-evident, and when steered with the bold use of anthropological imagination, they may assist us in seeing the unexpected in the mundane. That is, particularly when accompanied by a spirit of collegial solidarity and encouragement. My paper has formed one attempt to explore what such use of anthropological imagination might result in. I look warmly forward to your thoughts and comments, and thank you very much for your attention.